The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
And of course, it is time on this Friday for the program that you've been waiting for, The Digital World with your boy Kerron Rose and the Curtis Jordan. Kerron, good afternoon.
How's that?
Can you hear me loud and clear? Yeah, man.
Yeah, good afternoon and good morning, good. Curtis. How are you?
Are we good enough? We good enough. That's what we're declaring. Because we're in Trinidad and Tobago. So we're good. We're declaring. Oh, my gosh. We good. Yeah, man. How are you doing?
Listen to me. I can't complain. As I see right now is the festive time. I'm only seeing vibes. I'm seeing events. I'm seeing people coming in. It is always a good time this time of the year in Trinidad and Tobago. And, you know, it's good that we are getting to see just, you know, a couple weeks ago, it wasn't even looking like we would have had a carnival.
That's right. I am just glad that foreign exchange is coming in, even if it's in whatever amount it is. I'm just glad. We are seeing some foreign exchange coming in, and even heard some news from the central bank in December that there was an uptick in terms of our foreign exchange reserves. So all that good news is why I said today, yeah, man, we good. Yeah, man. And of course, despite that happening, we are also hearing a lot of carnival events would have been cancelled because of lack of funding. And it's just not feasible for them. Over 150 major events was reported that have been cancelled this year, which is huge. But yet still, we are pressing through, which is good. We are that kind of people, huh?
Yeah, and you know what though, it's good. And I mean, we'll definitely have this conversation after our interview that's coming up. But we'll definitely have to have this conversation about carnival, because I think one of the things that I just keep on seeing the rhetoric around is the government has to give, the government has to give, the government has to give. And here's the problem, right? For so many years, we have, for generations at this point, we have had two major oil booms. So we've had money flowing throughout the economy for a while. So it was easy to give money from the government to a lot of these events. It was easy to do that, right? But now it's at a point where every single interview I see, people are talking about government investment. Yeah. And it's like, on one hand, we're seeing we're not getting oil money. The country's not producing. We haven't diversified the economy. But on the flip side, we want government investment.
Yeah. I don't think we attributed that the investments came from our position in terms of an oil producing nation. I don't think we added that up.
No.
You understand what I mean?
We did not.
So when it's being pulled back, it feels strange. Like, what's happening here? Y'all just don't want to give us. You know, that's how it seems to come across. But it's not the reality.
So like I said, we definitely have to dive into that. But I mean, usually we have our interviews happening around the 1 o'clock hour, but we're going to be pushing our interview right up into this 12 o'clock hour. And we're going to be diving into some key points today, because let me tell you, everybody knows, you see, when it comes time to you want to sell products or services and we have to move money throughout the Caribbean region, we know that moving money throughout the Caribbean is costly. Mm-hmm. It is timely. It is not efficient. Yeah. We have so many gaps.
A lot of friction
taking place. We have a lot of friction that is taking place, right? And we all feel it. So today we're going to be discussing cross-border payments, because a good friend of mine, Mr. Raul Anand Singh, I saw him made a post this week talking about a new company and venture that he is rolling out. And when I saw the pain point that the company is looking to solve, I reached out and I said, Raul, we have to talk about this. Because again, it is such a problem. It is such a pain point. And again, anytime we can get our entrepreneurs who, you know, have traveled the world, who have done work all over the world, but they're here, they're at home, and they can solve major infrastructural problems, that is always going to be a good thing. So today we're going to be speaking with Mr. Raul Anansing from X-Border, which is a platform focused on rethinking cross-border payments for tourism businesses in Latin America and the Caribbean. And we're also going to be bringing in Mr. Neil Sumar, who is the founder of Luvoc. I'm always going to butcher this. Levuca. Neil, just give me. Okay, good. I think I nailed it. Levuca Venture Lab. And he is an advisor to X-Border. And he's going to be bringing in that global infrastructure and systems perspective to the conversation. So without further ado, because I want to maximize our full time with these two gentlemen, let's welcome to Digital World, Trinidad and Tobago, Mr. Raul and Neil. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
So happy to be here, Kieran, and to the entire Freedom 106 FM crew. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's a fabulous Friday in Trinidad and Tobago, so yeah, life is great.
Love it.
We love it. Neil, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having us. It's our pleasure to be here.
Now, Neil, where in the world are you right now? I think we just lost Neil. That's okay. Hey, when Neil comes...
My back? Yeah. Am I back?
Oh, okay. Oh, yes.
Sorry, guys.
Neil, you're back.
I was just saying, Kieran, I'm in Baja California Sur, Mexico, in a small surf town called Todos Santos right now.
He's in a surf town. You got it. Listen, I love the world that we live in today, right? This is an international conversation. Raul, are you in Trinidad right now, or are you outside the country?
I'm in Trinidad right now. Yeah, just came back from El Salvador and Panama, Barbados next month, but happy to be home for Carnival.
We got to get Neil down here one of these years for Carnival as well, if he hasn't already done it.
He hasn't been for Carnival, but he was just here in September last year. Yeah.
Okay, so we definitely got to get Neil in for a Carnival. Yeah.
Look forward to it.
This is a huge, huge deal. Like I said, I really wanted, as soon as I saw that you made that post, I said we definitely have to have this conversation, because you see, the conversation of moving money in any capacity right now is a major, major infrastructural problem that we have in the Caribbean. And I think even in my capacity in digital marketing and e-commerce, the number one question that I get asked has nothing to do with marketing. It has always to do with how do we get paid? How do we receive money? How do we move money? You know, what digital wallets do we have access to? Like, those are the main questions I get on a regular basis, right? And as much as we want people to start businesses, you know, we gotta understand how do we move money, how do we receive money, because all of these things gotta be considered when we are planning out the business. So let's kick things off, because you guys have really dug into this. When we talk about cross-border payments in the Caribbean being broken, let's start with that mountain. What is the problem? Because I don't think the general public understands. We know that we go to the bank, we try to do a wire transfer, the bank tells us, well, no, we have no foreign exchange, so we can't process your cross-border payment, right? What is the problem when it comes to cross-border payments in the Caribbean? Raul, let's start with you, and then Neil, we want to bring you in right after all.
Yeah, really good question, Kieran. So if you allow me to just zoom out a little bit and sort of set the context around it as well, right? When we look at global markets right now, traditional banking rails have become lethargic. They're slow, they're expensive, they lack innovation, and they're not keeping up with some of the trending technologies, especially as it relates to AI, crypto, blockchain. In particular, my background is actually in tourism and hospitality management. So when I looked at that sector in particular, globally, $400 billion is moving across borders. And of that $400 billion, approximately $40 to $60 billion resides outside of the IATA framework. IATA is the International Air Transport Association, right, that governs most, close to 95% of the airlines in the world falls under the IATA framework. But there's a big chunk that falls outside of it. And what's happening right now is that, A, if you are already inside and you're part of IATA, you have seamless options available to you to remit payments to your vendors, to your suppliers. But if you're outside of that framework, and again, $40 to $60 billion worth is outside of that framework, then there's a lot of friction. You know, so you're depending on traditional banking rails, like making international wire transfers. They are lengthy, could take anywhere from 1 to 3 business days to settle. They're expensive. Then you're exposed to the FX volatility in terms of the exchange rates. So what we've seen now is, with technology, we can solve those problems. And that technology is stablecoin. So stablecoin is a derivative of crypto. It takes all the good of crypto and leaves all the bad aside. So stablecoins is pegged in value 1-to-1 with a fiat currency, in this case, the US dollar, as the example. So it is a perfect form of payments, not necessarily for trading, not for investments, but as a form of payments. It almost replaces your fiat currency. So that's the problem that we identified. So looking within our backyard now, of that 40 to 60 billion global tourism market, the Caribbean, the Americas, we own a big chunk of that, right? When we look at tourism inflows coming from Europe, from North America. So the challenge here is, when online travel agents or brick and mortar travel agents in our neck of the woods receive payments from their customers, how do they remit those payments to the vendors, whether it's airlines, hotels, tour operators, or transportation companies? They encounter those same frictions I mentioned before. So that's really the problem that we're trying to solve. We're starting with more mature markets where the problem is bigger. And then over time, we're hoping to work with the region, because as you would know, Kieran, you're in the space where we still sort of fall behind the curve where the legislation is concerned. You know, so, you know, in the US, they recently enacted the Genius Act. In Europe, there's the MiCA Act to support stablecoin and crypto. Recently here in Trinidad, we had the passage of the Virtual Assets and Virtual Assets for Service Providers Bill. So we're on the right track, but we're not there yet in terms of being able to 100% support the industry. So we've taken an approach that, hey, let's build. Let's get to proof of market. Let's test the concept. Let's solve the problems in more mature markets while simultaneously working with the regional governments, and then hopefully, you know, we'll get on par with more developed markets.
Good. Neil.
Yes, sir.
Talk to us. What do you see from the outside looking in? What are you seeing?
Happy to share. So, you know, my background, Kieran, my family's originally from the South Pacific, from the Fiji Islands. So different island chain, but, you know, suffers from similar constraints. So when we kind of look at this from, you know, and our venture lab operates globally. So we're, you know, domiciled in Dubai. I've had experience structuring sort of businesses and transactions across, you know, multiple regions from, you know, Africa, Asia, the United States, Latin America. And so when we, to Raul's point, when we zoom out and look at this, you know, Raul's business, X-Border, you know, is a very interesting example because it does solve the payment rail problem. But when you think about the nature of this issue, even stable coins themselves are backed by cash or short-term treasuries, right? So you still, they're a digital representation of USD. Now, in island communities and, you know, Latin American communities where USD is literally short, in shortfall, there's not enough of it, this becomes challenging. So, you know, it forces innovators, you know, great businesses like what Rawls developing, the markets in the Caribbean aren't quite ready to receive the benefit of these stablecoin rails even because they're behind on legislation. And sometimes they just don't have the USD liquidity to support, right? You got to fund the stablecoin to start, right? So the when we think about that problem on a more macroeconomic lens, you know, it may seem like a challenge for these smaller island communities, but actually, you know, the reason Levuka is there and the reason we see these things is I think it presents an opportunity. So, you know, we're thankful to have these conversations because it raises this awareness that, you know, we look at markets like the U.S. as maybe being more mature. But to Rawls' point, you know, there's a $30 billion payment issue that he's solving with Xborder in the most mature market in the world. So I think that, you know, we have a lot of innovative sort of builders throughout the Caribbean and other regions that, you know, now with technology, with AI and blockchain technology, this actually presents an opportunity for these, maybe these communities in these regions that were traditionally seen as being less innovative to actually use that technology to leapfrog competitors and become more innovative because these problems need to be solved, right? So
yes.
I think like from our global perspective, we sort of look at it and say, you know, sometimes we focus too much on these being constraints or challenges within the region, but truly they kind of present an opportunity because the gap isn't maybe as big as we think it is, right? So we want to like let people know that like, you know, these problems need to be solved. It's interesting that people like Rawl who are reside in the Caribbean, you know, we have to solve these problems sometimes first in more developed markets, right? Yeah. But it's not without attention to what we can do in our own backyards.
No, I want to jump in quick with, because so many things are just going off in my head concerning this conversation, because it's a very big one for me. I do business overseas and locally. And my thought, especially to Mr. Anand Singh, is what is your thought pattern at the inception of this, where there are two things happening. One, the average Caribbean, well, especially Trinidad and Tobago national, they're getting less and less access to US dollars or less and less access to credit cards or credit to be able to fund the coins and whatnot. And secondly, the mindset of adoption, because, you know, it's a whole cultural shift. Like, where are your thoughts along that line to us getting access and culturally adopting something different, you know?
Yeah, really, really good questions. I'll address the second question first. So what I've discovered through my own personal and professional experiences is that creativity is often born out of necessity, right? So looking at home, looking at our region, look at what's happening in Venezuela, look at what's happening in Argentina, for example, where inflation is concerned. How did they solve it? They immediately leapfrogged and went to crypto, right? Yeah. So you go to Caracas now, everybody on the street, and Kieran, you've been there, right? Everybody in the street, they're settling payments on their mobile device.
Yeah.
They're using Binance. Why? Because they were forced to. They didn't have another choice. Otherwise, they'll be lugging around like a backpack of fiat cash, right? which is not practical. Wow. So I think yes, we still have a lot of educating to do, a lot of building the awareness around the utility of these new technologies. And I think in doing so, we need to focus not on what the technology is. Nobody cares that it's stablecoin. What people care about is the problem that's being solved in their own use cases, in their own personal and professional life. If it's solving a problem for them, they will adopt the new technology, because that's exactly what happened in Caracas, in Argentina. The person on the street is using it. Some of them don't even have a fancy education, right? But they're adopting the technology out of necessity.
Right.
With regards to your first question, though, that's a bit more tricky to answer. I'll touch on it, but I'd like Neil to expand on it a bit as well. Xborder can't solve the liquidity crisis where foreign exchange is concerned. right? We are solving the ease of moving money across borders. So we are at the second juncture where you already have the cash to move across borders, right? If you're looking at the first step, I think the first step is around addressing at a very macro level our import-export imbalances, right?
Yeah.
So if we're to look at Trinidad and Tobago in particular, almost everything that we consume now is imported.
Yeah.
Right? That's a problem, and it's not sustainable, right? We had an over-reliance on the energy sector. We have been trying over the years to diversify the economy, and you know, we can debate on how successful we have been in moving that needle forward, but I think obviously we're all feeling it, so clearly a lot more has to be done, right? But Neil can touch on some really innovative solutions that we're sort of looking at exploring that could not necessarily solve the crisis, but help it move the needle forward a little bit. Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to add to what Raul's saying, you know, when we look at the USD crisis in and of itself in Trinidad and Tobago, this is not something where we can import more USD, right?
Yeah.
This requires reliance on correspondent banking relationships and, you know, from a banking lens, if it's not realistic to get more USD, because, you know, the banks will say, well, where are we going to get the USD from? And Raul's absolutely 100% right. These are import geographically, right? They have to be reliant on imports. So when you don't have the ability to, and then there's a second component, which Raul touched on, which is often when we start talking about things like stable coins and payment rails that involve cryptocurrencies, because they're still deemed a cryptocurrency, this requires large reform, right? We hear sometimes conversations that come up in these regions of central bank digital currencies or stable coin payments and things like that. But those things require large legislative changes. They require, you know, user education and adoption. Sometimes the problem has to be solved in a more simple manner that creates less friction. So when you have a shortfall of USD, the other way to solve it is through better sequencing and timing of how that USD is actually allocated, right? So we're exploring, Raul and I are exploring in the region, specifically in Trinidad and Tobago, but you know, we're open throughout the Caribbean, to working with, you know, partners, import partners, banks, to sort of develop pilots where we have models where we can actually start to fix the timing issue of how USD is allocated. It becomes about velocity, just like inventory. If USD is your inventory as a bank or as a country, if you turn your inventory faster, you can use the same amount of inventory more times throughout the course of a year.
Right.
So, you know, we're looking to solve that problem to say, you know, it's not realistic to go through a 5-year legislative change to get, you know, full buy-in from everybody and then go through the change in user behavior. What's more realistic is to take a crawl, walk, run approach where we're solving the sequencing and timing issue to say, hey, we can take the same amount of USD, but accelerate the velocity, how many times we can use it by, you know, using some things that don't require stable coins and don't require legislative changes, just require us to be able to collaborate with the right sort of regional partners to test it, right? So, you know, these are interesting problems that we can try to solve, you know, with the region. You know, but there has to be a willingness on all sides, right?
That's it. Yeah. No, Karen,
that willingness is a big one. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Curtis. What I'm hopeful of with what Mr. Roll would have shared earlier concerning the stablecoin and that kind of situation is the fact that we don't even have to look very far to see something that works. Right next door in Guyana, they have a situation called MMG. I'm not sure if you guys ever heard about that, but it's like a wallet. But everybody, when I say everybody, I work with students over there. So the minute we have to reach to the point of them paying me for something, the first thing they all ask is, what's my MMG? I had no clue what that was about until I had to relate with them overseas. And everybody on the streets of Guyana have an MMG account, and it's something, of course, like a loadable wallet. I don't know exactly how it goes, but it's the adoption to me is huge. And if they could go so far into an adoption, and they consider themselves to be simpler people that don't like too much drama and they like things simple, we who consider ourselves to be highly high tech. We are fully high tech here. I think it should be adopted quicker than we expect. So yeah. I'm pushing. I'm cheering you on to make this happen.
Take a look at what's happening in bigger emerging markets, right? If you look at the African continent, there's a huge swath of the population that's underbanked and underserved.
Yeah.
So they have leapfrogged, right? So now you have, for example, charitable organizations based in Europe sending hundreds of millions of euros to the African continent, and the last mile delivery is being done via M-Pesa. So they're getting the money on their phones,
right?
Because they don't have a bank account,
right?
So they are those are some of the nuanced situations that encourage us to, as a society, to sort of leapfrog. Now, bringing the conversation back home a little bit, where the virtual assets and the virtual asset providers bill is concerned, I think as a population, when we think about blockchain or crypto, some red flags raise. You know, we think about the anti-money laundering, we think about the fraud, exactly. We think about artists, the scammers
Bahamas.
Right, there we go, right? So I think the government's approach is prudent. They are saying, okay, guys, we don't yet have all the pieces of the puzzle together in terms of how we should construct this legislative framework. So let's, in the meantime, ensure that we're protecting the citizenry against anti-money laundering, against fraud, against the scammers, etc. So buying that time to sort of build trust, ensure that we have the safety frameworks. And shout out to my Fatima boy, Rudvin Thompson, who's listening right now, and he's feeding me with some good little nuggets. So I think all of that is top of mind locally as well, where because we don't know, because we're not fully, fluent in that world, we're sort of, still fearful. But again, I bring it back to when you don't have a choice, you adopt technologies and then you iterate as you go along.
Can you guys, because the average person listening to this program right now is the man on the ground, right? They have no idea about the plumbing and the back end that goes into facilitating cross-border payments and transactions. All they know is that they have a client or they have somebody they want to send money to right next door in Grenada or Barbados, and the bank tells them, well, we can't facilitate that transaction, or we could only send 100 US and you want to go and send 500 US, but they don't have it. And if they are able to send it, it's taking days, there's a fee. Can you guys, for the average person, break down and explain why the legacy framework for moving money is slow and expensive? What is it that makes it slow? What is it that makes cross-border payments expensive for us? Even if we're trying to send, how long is a flight to Barbados? What, half an hour, 40 minutes? These places are so close to us, right? So just break it down for the average person. Why is this slow and why is it expensive? What goes into it?
Yeah, do you want me to feel that one, Raul?
Yeah, Neil, jump in, man.
Jump in, yeah.
Yeah, happy to. So, if we look at this fundamentally, and it's a great question, Kieran, because I think this often gets overlooked, right? And not overlooked because people don't care, but to your exact point, the common user, even just in traditional payments, they credit card payment, right? Nobody thinks about how that credit card is actually like transacting with the bank and how money moves. All we care is like, I got to go buy that cup of coffee or that, you know, that jar of whatever I'm buying at the store. So, you know, this really happens. The core problem here is because of the way in banking, correspondent banking relationships work, right? So each bank has a fee and a compliance check that must be met for funds to settle across jurisdictions. Without getting into the nuances and boring people with the details of banking, what that effectively means is a bank in Trinidad and Tobago needs to have a relationship with a bank that can facilitate the disbursement of USD in another region. That account, like if a Trinidad and Tobago importer was dealing with a company in Miami to send them anything, mattresses, right? Whatever it is, they have to have a correspondent banking relationship or a relationship with the exporter's bank in that region. And that has to be funded with USD so the payments can be released. So it becomes, when we talked earlier about sequencing and timing, it becomes about a sequencing and timing issue because by nature, the banks relying on these correspondent banking chains, that's where the settlement takes a longer period of time. Because to the analogy you used earlier, I want to send $500, you only have $100, and it's not even that $100 is delivered to my friend in Guyana instantly. It's like it takes 5 to 7 days for it to even get to you, right? So there's that whole other problem, right? And so that is really because of the legacy infrastructure of how banking works. Now, when we talk about stable coins and payment rails, they're built on the blockchain. And the advantage of the blockchain is it's an immutable ledger, meaning that that transaction is now logged and visible, right? To, and it could be private or public, but it cannot be, it's instantaneous. So it eliminates the need of needing this correspondent relationship because I can transfer and settle funds directly to the receiver. The challenge becomes, if the person that I want to transact with, buy that cup of coffee with, doesn't want to receive my form of stablecoin payment, that's the gap, right? So it requires that user adoption side. But traditionally, this exists because banks require their correspondent banking relationships to settle and clear these transactions across regions. And that becomes slow and cumbersome. And when you have massive global infrastructure that's dependent on this across every region, right? Because this applies to any import-export relationship. The constraint is that small island nations and smaller economies sometimes are limited on how much USD they can actually disperse for these transactions. So that's where the bottleneck happens, right? Effectively, if that explains it.
It does.
Let me just build on a point too that Neil raised there. With regards to the adoption of crypto and stablecoin, so if I look at export as a use case, and again, I take this back by putting the customer first, right? The customer doesn't care that it's stablecoin or crypto. The customer only cares that you're able to solve their problem, right? So with exporter, it's designed to be that way. We don't introduce stablecoin or crypto into the customer conversation. All the customer knows is that they're sending $100 from Trinidad and Tobago, and that $100 shows up in Germany in euros. That's all they know.
Yeah.
How we do it behind the scenes is leveraging stablecoin rails. But we go from a fiat currency to another fiat currency end to end. The customer doesn't care.
Yeah, and you know what? And it's a very good point. The average person doesn't care how the problem gets solved as long as it's getting solved. And I think now more than ever, though, because the average person doesn't know how the problems have been solved, you know, to this point, they can't understand, you know, years ago I could have walked into the bank and sent money, $500 to Guyana or to Grenada, and now you're telling me I can't do it, and I've been doing it this whole entire time. So I think now is a good time for people to get to kind of understand the nuances and the problems so that they can have an idea as to how much of a problem we have in TNT, and not just TNT, but the Caribbean, and why this is such a massive problem to get solved. Curtis?
No, I'm thinking because of this entire conversation that we really have a systems issue. and the systems issue based on what Mr. Neal would have just said, it is attached to us being small nation and have less access to U.S. and whatnot. But then we cannot stretch our nation. We cannot add more land, all of a sudden become a big nation. We only have 1.5 million people here. But then what do you think is the next frontier for us to kind of maneuver this situation that we could still now access the systems that will make things happen quicker? If that, you catch me there, right?
Yeah. You know, Curtis, I think that there's a couple of things. It goes back to solving, you know, when we have these constraints, right? We have to work with what we can solve.
Right.
What we can solve for is sequencing and timing of how that USD is allocated across,
right,
you know, these transactions. That's a solvable, more solvable lens to start with.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wanted to touch on something I think that you bring up that's very important. And I want to let Raul comment on this as well. But, you know, this problem is also a much larger problem that we're seeing globally, right? Because we want to pay attention to the macroeconomic signals. You know, even when we talk about what Raul was saying earlier with, you know, M-Pesa in Africa or MMG in Guyana and all these different sort of payment apps, you know, there's larger precedent, right? Alipay, WeChat, you know, these are large infrastructure that are using mobile services. But the reason I bring that up is those regions are also acutely aware of competing settlement rails outside of USD, right? There's a much larger macro problem here where some of these payment infrastructure, you know, is we're seeing, you know, situations like what's happening in, you know, a neighboring country in Venezuela and other places that are putting certain constraints on not just access to USD, but countries and regions are having to choose how do we want to progress into the future, right? We're seeing a much more multipolar, you know, understanding emerge, right? And, you know, we're seeing patterns and capital markets, even allocation of capital. And I've spoke about this a little bit in the past and wrote about it, you know, around, you know, sovereign revocability. So we have to consider when we put our eggs in the basket of USD or another currency, you know, or whatever we're doing, do we truly have control? And I think, you know, this presents an open door opportunity for small island countries because the advantage we have is we can pivot on a dime, right? Much faster than larger countries that have, you know, much more ingrained infrastructure. So, you know, yes, that's a constraint, but it also presents an opportunity for us to take a step back, be a little bit more reflective before we compress this into a resolution and say, how do we take a responsible approach and not just a responsible approach to fix my problem today, which is how do I send, you know, Curtis money in another country, but how do I solve this so that our grandchildren in these regions actually have sustainable infrastructure, right? And so I think this is an opportunity to pause and consider that long arc trajectory for how we reshape. And the last point I'll make is this is being compounded by the latest research from OECD and other things that sort of, you know, countries and regions look at with on their research in terms of what shapes policy. The reason I bring that up is things like AI are actually creating disparity, right? They're not creating the gap, they're accelerating the gap that exists. So what that means is that a small region that maybe is less is more constrained, but is quicker to invent, quicker to adopt, can actually leapfrog significantly over competitors that are less innovative if they move quick. But that window is going to close. So we have to be aware, right? So we can't move too quick. We have to be responsible, but we have to leverage the tools around us to ensure we're making the most responsible decision to, for me, on that long arc, which is like, are these regions sustainable for our grandchildren?
It's funny whenever I hear that we need to move quick, and I'm like, do you guys realize this is the Caribbean? You know, and it's funny. It's funny because, you know, we come to the Caribbean for the laid back nature, right? And that laid back nature was perfect for our time, you know, for many, many years.
Oh, yeah.
But now in today's time where we have to move quick and we have to be on the pulse, that laid back nature of ours is almost working against us right now. Now, for you gentlemen. Raw, you're going to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly comment on that. I mean, yeah. Kieran, you also know that I'm involved with innovation ecosystem development. Yeah. So to your point about us being laid back and slow, I would say from perhaps a government perspective, a corporate perspective, yes, but startups are quick, nimble, innovative. So if we're looking at those innovative solutions, for me, the solution lies with investing more in entrepreneurs. They're the ones who are going to bring those solutions to market.
1,000% agree. Now, one of the biggest things I'll always tell people, especially when you're coming from the islands, exposure matters, right? And one of the main reasons why I decided to move out to Thailand was I wanted to be in Asia and I wanted to be up close and personal. And I wanted to see the latest and greatest as it is happening. And in being here, one of the things that I have seen is ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is kind of like our CARICOM, and I'm just saying that for the listening public. They're basically like our CARICOM, right? One of the things that they did to solve their cross-border payments, and this is why they have some of the best infrastructure when we're talking about super applications like Grab, Lazada, Shopee, these types of things where they have solved cross-border payments. One of the things that they did was from a policy perspective, the entire ASEAN has agreed to settle their cross-border payments in their local currencies, and they don't transact in U.S. dollars. Now, for you two gentlemen, how does that approach compare to stablecoins? Is stablecoins and going the route that you're going with exporter, is that a shortcut to kind of get away from some of the bureaucracy? Because I know with what ASEAN is doing, that's going to require governments and all of the central banks to all get on board. Is going the stablecoin route kind of like a quicker route to get to transacting cross-border, to getting cross-border payments? What are your thoughts on that, Raul, and then Neil will come in.
Yeah, so I'll touch on it briefly. I mean, from my perspective, coins are inherently interoperable, right? So there's that built-in trust because it resides on a blockchain. So that built-in trust, the accountability is there. It's on a very transparent ledger. And that interoperability allows consumers to easily move from one coin to another. To your point about it being tied to specific fiat, though, what we're seeing is not just a prevalence of sort of more national level pegging happening, but we're also seeing a lot of corporate private companies now issuing their own coins, but still backed by a fiat currency. So I think coins will definitely allow us to have that flexibility of not necessarily holding our assets tied to any one currency. But Neil, you wanna dive in and share a bit more?
Yeah, love to, and I love that you brought this up, Kieran, because ASEAN is a very interesting example, right? In many contexts. So, what ASEAN is doing, sort of on a sort of macroeconomic level, is they're operating as a power block. And in operating as a power block, that creates tremendous efficiency, right? And these are models that pre-exist that we can learn from in other regions that are capable of unifying. And what ASEAN's doing is not operating like a power block like the EU did, where they had one currency and one stable coin and initiatives like that. They're saying that it's less friction. We're able to create the plumbing and the rails to adopt more things across these regions, but we'll operate where it's efficient in terms of leverage, right, across all the countries that are part of ASEAN. So that's a really interesting example because they're not taking the traditional approach of saying, which dollar are we going to peg to, USD or euro? Which dollar are we going to peg to? Are we in the camp of, you know, what's happening with the other elephant in the room, you know, with China, and what's happening with the yuan and the e-yuan or the USD, right? And stablecoin, digital stablecoins. They're saying we're building a different, a third sort of economic model where these countries that independently have less leverage have unified on certain governments, technology, or stablecoin initiatives, not to operate as this is our one AI platform or one stablecoin platform, but we're going to collaborate to make this less friction and more leverage as a group. And I think that's a beautiful example that regions like, you know, the South Pacific, where my family's from, or the Caribbean, can really sort of, you know, take to heart.
Curtis. I know in the past there was an effort for CARICOM to adopt a Caribbean coin. It didn't make it past the gate, but I mean, ASEAN is a good example that it can be done, right?
It absolutely can be done. And like I said, you seeing it in action and with all of the countries in that are under ASEAN. And again, you can do business with Indonesia. You could do business with Cambodia. You could do business with Malaysia. And you're sending payments, you know, instantaneously. And I love the fact that, again, they all agreed to come together and say, you know what, we're going to settle all of our payments, cross-border payments, in our local currencies. You know, I would love to see, you know, CARICOM. There's so many things that I would love to see CARICOM look at ASEAN, and if there was ever a time to copy homework. Now would have been the time, Curtis.
I'm thinking, based on my first questions, what if things turn in the right direction where we now start to get access to U.S. and people can purchase or purchase coins? And what if we become creative as a people to look at or be open to other ways of payment? What would be the first impact businesses like listening right now would feel? Anybody?
Locally, Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah. What would we feel? What would the businesses listening now would feel? What would be their new experience if those things come into play?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a child on Christmas morning. You know, they wake up all excited and they run to the tree and their presents underneath and the world is their oyster. You know, right. So all of a sudden it unleashes possibilities. It unleashes creativity. It allows us to dream. It allows us to be optimistic about the future, and with that, then anything is possible. Really, I mean, Kieran is living in the future, right? Kieran is in Thailand, so he could say exactly what it would be like. He is living in the future, right? So, you know, and I just wanted to touch on, I mean, I know we spoke about a coin for the Caribbean, but even with regards to our local legislation, all we have to do as well is to look at how the US adopted it with the Genius Act, look at how Europe adopted theirs with the MiCA Act. So in other words, we don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel, right? More mature markets, they have already done the homework. They already enacted these bills. Lessons learned, and we pull the good from it, leave the bad aside, and make it ours, customize it, and make it 100% Caribbean, 100% TNT.
Wow.
Good thing, so just to add one. Oh, go ahead, Curtis. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add one comment. I was going to say, you know, just going back to that ASEAN example, right? They're not building something to challenge the dollar. They're building rails so that the dollar no longer gets to decide, right? And they're not doing that by imposing themselves as a gorilla in the room. They're being strategically smart, right? Sometimes when you have a, you know, think about it in terms of how governments are formed. Sometimes a strategic minority can actually help swing decisions better than a you know, by the nature of how it's constructed. So I think the Caribbean can think about those things. So I think to your question, Curtis, you know, what does it look like? Well, it like pie in the sky, of course, if we had infinite USDT, it would mean we, you know, we don't have these shortfalls. We can create more leverage and trade amongst, you know, more countries and more regions. But even working within the constraints that are there, you know, thinking about these examples, exactly what Raul said, just because somebody's done it in Europe or somewhere else doesn't mean it's better. But those examples and those precedents show us, you know, Europe is regulatory safe, slow to move, right? There's constraints with working with the dollar. But, you know, these other regions, you know, are learning and adapting. And I think it's saying what, not just like what ASEAN has done, but taking those examples and saying, how does that apply uniquely to the Caribbean or LATAM, you know, to be more successful as a group? I think that's where the real leverage comes in.
Agreed. Now, I know our gentlemen have a very busy afternoon and we have them for 2 minutes left. So really quickly, Raul, come in first. When we're talking about X border, just give us a brief overview of what X border is and what it's about for anybody that's just tuned in, and then where they can get more information about X border.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kieran, and I appreciate sharing our insights with your listeners today. So X border, so it's X as in the letter X, BORDR. .com. We're now in closed beta testing, so we're not open to the general public just yet, onboarding our first users. And we're here to serve the tourism market, you know, helping tourism businesses move their money across borders faster, quicker, and shielding them from that FX volatility. More than that, though, I'm happy to work with entrepreneurs who are building anything innovative and exciting. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. I also lead the Founder Institute Caribbean chapter. So we run two accelerators per year, really passionate about the innovation ecosystem. And I'm here to give more than I receive. So just putting that out there. Much love.
I love it. And Neil, finally, real quick, these problems that the region are facing right now, do you feel like we need to have these problems right now so that true entrepreneurs can pull up their socks and start to solve some of the Caribbean's biggest and most long-standing problems? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, Kieran, quickly, I would say that, you know, this is an important time, right? We're seeing technology actually create opportunity at a pace that we've never seen before. The AI revolution alone is, to me, greater change to what humanity can do than the internet. So, you know, to my earlier point, you know, we have to be aware of that. And, you know, what Raul's creating in terms of Founder Institute and the innovation ecosystem, giving, you know, I don't want to say young, but early founders an opportunity to, you know, leverage on his knowledge and what he's building for the region is so important, because, you know, and our involvement is there to show these people and the region that, like, we're here to support, we're here to grow with you, right? So I think, like, the time is now, right? So I agree with you. These constraints need to be turned into leverage and creativity. And it's the old adage, right? Like, scarcity is the mother of innovation. And we want to, you know, really seize that, right?
Neil, where can the Freedom Family find you online if they want to follow you?
Yeah, Levuka Labs is the website. So LEVUKALABS.com. We do, you know, multi-jurisdictional structuring and project sort of engineering in the tech and finance space. And also I'm on LinkedIn, so they can find me there. But yeah, appreciate your guys' time and having us.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Raul and Neil. Thank you, gentlemen, for both jumping in on the Digital World program and giving us a full breakdown. This is some big issues that you guys are solving. So much power to you. And again, it's because of you guys that you guys are going to be solving a lot of these issues and giving us some real hope for the future. So thank you, gentlemen, for your time today.
Thank you guys.
Very much. Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, Kieran, and to all the listeners today. Happy and safe carnival.
Yes, definitely.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.